This episode of the No Film School podcast is brought to you by Rode Microphones and Blackmagic Design. Hi, I'm John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Here we are, live from Utah, and our first interview is from a film called Arizona. Bizarre, right? Well, not nearly as bizarre as the film itself. Set in the midst of the 2009 housing crisis, this darkly comedic story follows Cassie Fowler, played by Rosemary DeWitt, a single mom and struggling realtor whose life goes off the rails when she witnesses a murder. The man who committed the murder, played by Danny McBride, proceeds to take her hostage, and she must do her best to escape the grasp of his insanity. The result is a film that quickly alternates between dark comedy and horror slasher, which makes sense considering the team behind it will be responsible for the Halloween sequel that's coming next year. Director Jonathan Watson has been part of David Gordon Green and McBride's Roughhouse production company since Eastbound and Down, but this is his first shot at the helm of a feature. To enhance that slasher vibe, he employed the talents of composer Joe Stevens. I sat down with Joe and Jonathan moments ago to talk about how a great score can be used to influence your audience, the typical workflow of audio post-production, and how a composer can stand out in the biz. Enjoy. Hey everybody, it's John Fusco, and I'm here at Sundance. I have two guests with me. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. We're going to talk Arizona and sort of the collaboration between a composer and a director. So, starting with you, Joe.
Joseph Stevens, composer for Arizona.
Jonathan Watson, director of Arizona.
Great. So, I guess let's just start this with a pretty basic question. How do you guys work together? What's your process like?
Well, this is my first movie, so... I can't really speak to my quote process. Mm-hmm. This specific movie, where there's a few things that were challenges. That the first one is that we don't live in the same city.
That's tough.
And so we have during the making of the movie we would meet up in a third city. So I live in Los Angeles. Joseph lives in. You live in Charlotte.
No, Charlotte, yeah.
Yeah,
North
Charlotte.
Carolina.
Yeah, Charlotte. And we would meet in Charleston, South Carolina.
What was the purpose of that?
Because the Roughhouse Gang had moved to Charleston to prep for Halloween. Mm. And basically, we all shot Vice Principals. Mm. And we shot a two-season production where we shot two seasons in one go. So it was a seven-month shoot. To shoot two seasons of the HBO show Vice Principals in Charleston. And Danny McBride and David Gordon Green, who's also our kind of Roughhouse partner, and Jody Hill, all moved there for the production of that. David and Danny loved it so much, they moved there permanently. David moved from Austin, Danny moved from Los Angeles.
Wow.
And they set up their base of operations in Charleston, South Carolina.
Is there like a film scene there, or is it just
there is now?
No, nice. That's good to know.
And they're making Halloween, the new Halloween there, yeah, as we speak.
So how early into that did you have him on board during the actual production of the film, as far as like would you get sent dailies or anything to sort of work with?
I got involved, you know, during the edit. Mm-hmm. I've worked with Jonathan before with Vice Principals and Eastbound and Down, just never in this capacity. So we, you know, had a relationship, a working relationship, but never in this capacity. Yeah. And so, once you guys had an assembly, mm-hmm, I got a cut somewhat, you know, early on, I suppose. And I started sending ideas.
Yeah.
And then we just whittled some ideas down, figure out what would stick and what didn't stick. And then there's some, you know, like with every score, there's always like easy moments and hard moments, or, you know, things that don't find their, you know, it takes a while to get to where it needs to be. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm, you know, but it was, you know, a lot of communication over internet and telephone. And then the occasional, you know, meeting in Charleston.
Yeah. what were some notes that, I guess you gave him, in this initial stage?
The challenge of the movie, the hardest part of the movie for me was this kind of tonal minefield, mm-hmm, and this genre blending aspect of the movie. It's also what drew everybody to wanting to do it, what drew Danny to do it initially, me to do it. It is because it's not one thing. It's not. It's funny, scary, crazy, weird movie. And if you don't get the score right, then you shatter. If you're trying to walk a tightrope of tone, mm-hmm. and if you lead too much, or if you pull back, or you push into another direction, you can fight yourself, and then you're chasing your tail. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You mm-hmm. get into this whirlpool of like, well, now it sounds too dark. Now it sounds too light. Now it sounds too whimsical, and it's tough. I mean, it was some of these parts that we were trying to find, or I was trying to find in the edit, to kind of just nail exactly that, the right level of horror or comedy. The score was instrumental in pulling that off.
Yeah, I think when early on in the film, when the main character starts to make a sort of a dark turn, or when his character starts to develop, that was the tricky area of trying to not tip the hat too much, but not playing it, you know, too, you know, comedic or right. anything like that. Yeah. But we didn't want to give it away, but it's also very weird what he's doing, so we can't not acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once the character and everything gets completely insane, it kind of gets easier because we're just committed to making it sound insane and right. more, you know, kind of madcap and just, you know, loud and, you know, more powerful. But the subtleties of the beginning of the score, that was kind of the tricky part. Yeah, just trying to figure out how to kind of toe that line, or like which way to go, like how far left or right, you know, how dark or light, or do we want to go?
Yeah, it really does like set up that weird world of Arizona during this crisis, I guess. It's almost like science fiction in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like lonely and
deserted,
cold.
Deserted moonscape. A sunburnt, deserted moonscape.
Yeah.
So was that an influence for you while writing the score at all?
Yeah, I think for me it was, I wanted to explore a lot of weird sounds, and we knew early on that we were going to have this sort of kind of grindhouse electronic thing, you know, that has this, because that kind of helps play the dark and the funny at the same time, you know, where it's not a true horror film that's like has no light in it at all. It has a genre element that, you know, has when paired against some of these scenes and some of these performances, they take on another kind of comedic, you know, level without being comedic music or horror music. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I think that certainly visually, seeing some of what these shots look like and seeing some of these burnt out houses and abandoned lives, you know, was a big part of like trying to find sounds that were, you know, eerie and lonely and, you know, angry and desperate, you know, those kinds of things. And yeah, it was certainly dictated by the setting. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you give him any temp music to work with, or was it kind of just...
Yeah, I mean, yes, there was in the very first cut, there was a bunch of temp music, and that,
yeah, there was
that can be the blessing and the curse, because, you know, if you fill a cut with, you know, John Carpenter music that everybody loves, but it's not right, mm-hmm. you can, you know, again, you can kind of cheat yourself into it's that thing where you just naturally don't want to be looking at a cut with nothing.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's, if you can deceive yourself with temp music that is pushing it in the wrong direction.
I see.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a slippery slope with temp music.
Yeah, I mean, this had to be edited with some temp. I mean, some of the temp that you guys edited with was like from other scores that I had given you guys. Most of it was kind of a mixed bag, I guess. I didn't know a lot of it. I kind of not liking
Sicario and John Carpenter.
Lost themes, maybe. I saw a lot of John Carpenter in that.
Oh, yeah.
Just because I'm like listening to, I've been listening to Lost themes a lot because it's something that I'm trying to use as temp music for my own short.
Yeah, I know.
So it seems like a popular choice these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely... I think so. Yeah, we try to, you know, we use that as sort of a springboard and didn't want to go fully, you know, mm-hmm. committed to that vibe, but we did want to touch on it and kind of use elements, electronic kind of like pulsy elements of the kind of gross electronic feel almost, and then implementing guitars and some other you know, non-electronic elements, but some of it was sprung from Carpenter for sure.
Yeah, no, we're all fans of Carpenter.
Yeah, it's hard not to be. It's so good.
Yeah.
Like the last scene where he walks through. I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler. He walks through sort of a hydroponic garden. And I mean, the mood is just so Michael Myers in a way. Yeah. you know, like these people are hiding from the slasher.
Yeah, no, it's a monster in the house.
Which really like lends itself to, I think, like a genre that, you know, you're straddling these genres, but it's pushing towards a slasher film almost.
Yeah, absolutely. We were definitely pushing that phrase came up a lot, you know, with pushing the genre, making it feel, you know, pushing it, making it feel more in your face, you know, and kind of using that to our advantage because of this, it does toe the line of comedic and intense, you know, dramatic. You know, it can be with these performances and kind of the absurdity and insanity of a lot of it. It helped, and it kind of just, you know, felt easy. Not easy, but it felt natural,
right.
I suppose.
Yeah, it felt right.
What sort of strategies do you use to make a moment feel more lighthearted, for example, or like comedic?
Well, instrument choice, I guess, is one. Yeah. There's one cue in the movie that was like kind of the bane of all of, well, my existence for the film, the hardest one, like early on, like trying to figure out the tone and make it less dark. I think in the end, what we did was just stripped everything out and just used like a couple piano notes and made it, you know, it sounded eerie still. And there were some elements of what was in there before it got toned or pulled back. But, you know, I think it depends on instrument choice and how extravagant you want to go, how big, you know, with as many instruments and or keep it sparse and minimal. And I think in general, we took out a lot, score-wise, just to make it more, I mean, I know we did, like, make it more simplified. And
there were the moments, the really tricky moments where we didn't want to lead.
Yeah.
We didn't want to tip our hat. We didn't want to go too dark and lead them into, because it's part of the magic of the movie, I think, is its unpredictability. And when you think, you know, there's a moment where you think, oh, it's these who are going to unite over a common foe, and it's going to take another course, and then it does not. But if you tip your hand with kind of foreshadowing doom and gloom, you know, or you give anything that gives away the shock, you undercut the kind of gut punch of the shock, any kind of shocking reality.
I don't want to give anything away about the scene, but the one that I guess we'll call the unraveling scene, because no one else will know. But
yes, exactly.
It was so fun for me last night to watch that, because there's one scene in the movie that had like crazy big music in it, and you had the idea of like making this electronic beat, or making a, you know, keeping it like beat oriented, like letting a simple rhythm do the job of creating the tension as these actors are unraveling. And it was fun watching it last night, because it was amazing. It was great. I truly had forgotten but it was you know, I was sort of still used to the way it was, and so when it came out that way, I was like, oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. It's good.
Well, then, like, conversely, you know, you were talking about how you don't want to lead the audience to expect what's coming, mm-hmm. but would you ever use it in the opposite way, where you try and like throw them off?
Absolutely. We try to hide. Yes, and often, you know, the music will tease up a moment. You know, ratchet to a you know, a release, or to a pinnacle, mm-hmm. Or crescendo of action or drama. Mm-hmm. But we were constantly doing that. We were the moment in the kitchen with when Vicky tries to leave the house, mm-hmm. There was a moment where it did ratchet up, and it led you to a strike, mm-hmm. And that we'd like, no, we want to completely hide all that.
Right.
Do not want to tip our hand at any point.
Well, the movie has a lot of moments like that too, where there's a lot of build up to a, you know, it's like a thriller, you know, so that you're a lot of tension that has a release. And so, you know, it's important to kind of layer those, you know, and you can't make them all the same or make them all like heavy as hell, you know. It has to have some texture and an arc, you know. So that was the tricky part of the movie, you know, early on, just to kind of balance those, because knowing we're going to make it really big in the end, or, you know, make it all as big as we could.
There were definitely like some jump scare moments. Mm-hmm. Like literally the people next to me, like gasped audibly. I don't know. Could you guys hear those?
Oh, yeah. No, no. We're you know, a lot of people around me have seen the movie 30 times.
See, I was around people that had not seen it. It was amazing. Yeah, it was. I enjoyed it. It was like this woman in front of me, like there was one scene where one of the characters pops in the screen and she just like jumped up and had both of her hands around her ears, just like totally frightened, you know, which was perfect. And some of the violent things that happen in the movie are, they were also kind of shocking, you know, to some of these people, and it was in the right way. But they also kind of weirdly laughed, you know, at some of these moments, which is what we want, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Laugh at some violence.
So how did the score, like, how can you use the score to set up that jump scare, I guess? And like, because that seems like a pretty collaborative moment, because you're working with the edit, you're working with the director.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, there's a few of them that we would try different ways to do it, you know, with using just sounds for one thing, and then making something, you know, either affecting the sound at the moment of the jump or using the music after the scare to make it seem like it was a bigger scare. So like having a moment and then all of a sudden there's no music and you're just kind of playing with sound design or, you know, the environment, as opposed to, kind of, you know, having this big lasting cinematic filmic score moment, you know, could have like a jolt and be out. Mm-hmm. Steve had it, the editor had it, an idea that was using, like for one scare, we, instead of making a booming noise, we use a high pitch sound. So sort of went the opposite of like a thunderous thing and went to more of a kind of a, not clatter, but like a pierce kind of thing.
It was like a bird of prey.
Yeah, it was like a shriek. Yeah.
So how closely are you working with the sound designer in a sense? Like, is it given to, who gets it first?
Not, the sound designer doesn't come into deep in the game.
Yeah.
It's almost like after composer, director, and editor have had it for months. Mm. And then once you've got the cut and the music and then it's in, the sound designer is the last, you know, it's the last link in the chain. And then you go in for a week of sound mixing.
Okay. That's pretty much the industry standard then? It's okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
I've actually always been wondering that. I'm like, who do I hand it over to first?
But sometimes the edits can be, you know, months. I mean, you know, some people edit for much longer than you would think.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then once you've got, it's like, all right, once the cut's done and it's done, and then the score can still be worked on, but it shouldn't really. Mm-hmm. You should have it by the time you get to the sound design, because then they're gonna, then they go in and, you know, you dial up, you know, you go every single, you know, everything, that every foley, every footstep, every door, every creaking moment, every rattling can, you know. That's
and you want the score there for like while that happens.
Yeah, ideally each other. Ideally that's done, and you know, rare occasions you hear that sometimes they'll get that point. Movies, and they'll do a test and they'll get rid of the bring in a brand new composer.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like, you know, those are indulgent people.
That does happen more often these days than you'd think. I had a couple jobs last year that
you took over.
Yeah. That, and it was for a variety of reasons. It was, it does happen.
Black Magic Design creates the world's highest quality products for the feature film, post-production, and television broadcast industries. Black Magic Design's DeckLink capture cards launched a revolution in quality and affordability in post-production, while the company's Emmy Award-winning DaVinci color correction products have dominated the television and film industry since 1984. Founded by world-leading post-production editors and engineers, Black Magic Design is dedicated to allowing the highest quality video to be affordable to everyone, so the post-production and television industry can become a truly creative industry. The all-new VideoMic Pro Plus from Rode Microphones is the ultimate on-camera shotgun microphone. The VMP Plus is jammed-packed with features, including an automatic power function, perfect for the run-and-gun shooter, which automatically turns the microphone off when unplugged from the camera. A built-in battery door, which makes replacing the battery a breeze, plus it won't get lost. Multiple power options, digital switching, which will ensure user has ultimate capture of the audio signal at the source, reducing post-production and editing times, including a two-stage high-pass filter, a three-stage gain control, a high frequency boost, and a safety channel, which will help ensure the signal does not clip when unexpected spikes occur. That's the VideoMic Pro from Rode Microphones. So how did you get involved in the project at first while we're talking about, you know, bringing on composers to a project? Like, how does a composer get
hired? I work with Rough House a lot, and so I'm going to know about pretty much everything they're doing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they, Danny talked to me about it early on. They sent me a script. I went to a table read in LA. It was a, and I guess, I mean, it's kind of, I don't really know. I mean, other than just being friends with everyone, we're all started talking about this movie that we're all going to make.
This is a gypsy family tribe that started back with when they were all in film school together.
Okay. Film school.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not talking about that.
Yeah, North Carolina School of the Arts.
I actually wasn't in the School of the Arts.
What were you in?
I was in UNC Greensboro, which is like 15 minutes away.
Wow, you were an interloper.
That's right. I was friends with them all during that time, but yeah, never. I had a buddy that transferred and, you know, met all these guys in film school then, would do stuff for them, like scoring student films and whatnot. And
who was that?
Ben.
It's Ben Best, who used to be a writing partner of Danny McBride.
So if you are a composer and you're like trying to get work, what's the best way to do that? Because I was just going to say, I've been like sort of, I just had a Kickstarter and I was already being bombarded by like
people that wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of hustle for it. I mean, I think that it's a strange, I feel pretty lucky because a lot of the guys that I work with, most of the core group of guys that I work with are all friends I've known since college. And so we just kept doing stuff. It kind of like, you know, I didn't have to do a lot of the what a lot of composers do, or they go to conservatory, they go to school for it and study it, and or they go out to LA and start hustling and, you know, take a more like hitting the pavement kind of approach. I was fortunate enough to be, I was in a band that, you know, and all these guys are making movies and they would share music for the band, and then from the band to the films, and the films would sometimes get big and then or have some exposure. And then these guys are such good, Rough House guys are so great, and they're such good friends, and they just, you know, keep, you know, they want to work with their friends and who they have relationships with and who they're comfortable with. And so that just led to more work. And then by way of that, those jobs get more exposed. And so then as a result, I get more exposed. And so, you know, it kind of helps me, obviously. And so I kind of came up in a different way than a lot of people do, where I didn't have to pound the pavement in the same way. I mean, I had, you know, I'm still looking for jobs, you know.
Right.
But it, you know, it's I was lucky to be born into it with it's kind of a crew that is full, like a fully formed crew that like writes and produces and directs films and TV shows. And so I'm like the guy they didn't have a guy that did music except for me. So that's, and they, I guess they didn't need one. Yeah. So I was lucky in that sense. But I know a lot of guys a lot of guys come up through the music, like bands. There's so many. I had a conversation yesterday with another composer about how bands, a lot of bands these days, the music business is so tough that a lot of guys, you know, they look to films and to scoring gigs and, you know, by way of their bands, you know, having music placed in it. And a lot of those guys peel off from the bands and
I just met Marilyn Manson's new guitarist. He is Tyler Bates, who scored Guardians of the Galaxy and Sucker Punch.
You met him here?
No, he and our daughters go to school together.
Nice.
Well, that's really, that band thing is really interesting, because it seems like in that sense, it's almost converse too, that you'd get you can get band jobs from movies nowadays.
Yeah.
So what's attractive for you for a composer as a director? Like, what do you like to see in terms of collaboration?
I cannot really speak to that. In the sense, it was my first movie and I have Joey's a dear friend of mine, and I've always loved the music he's done. I love the music he did in Vice Principals and Eastbound. So I've seen him kind of grow and progress and become a better composer. Mm-hmm. I'm a film goer and as a cinephile, you know, I love music across the board. And, you know, as we were talking about before, the John Carpenters of the world and the Desplats, I love great composers and their work. And I think Joey is right up there. I think this score is magnificent.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, thanks. Thanks, guys. You had some crazy ideas in the beginning, like the well, the opening, there was a piece of music that you, the, what is it? It's the, what's the band? The Australian band, Midnight Oil.
What we ended up with, that piece of music, the Arizona, mm-hmm. what opens it?
Right.
It's like, it's great. You can't beat that.
How, so I guess we should get into music supervision and where that like, puts
a gentleman by the name of DeVoe Yates. Look him up. You should hire him for all your movies. He is tremendous.
Is that something that comes in? Where is that?
The first movie and the first song and the last song.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolute DeVoe Yates.
Yeah, fantastic.
Like he found, like I had this other idea, which for the opening music, DeVoe Yates, that song, the Arizona song, which is by one of the members of Paul Revere and the Raiders. What is his name? The singer of Paul Revere and the Raiders. And it was like a track that came out, I think it was on the Billy Jack soundtrack movie.
What?
Yeah, called Arizona.
Billy Jack?
Yeah, and that song is about, it's about like a conservative boyfriend chiding his hippie girlfriend.
I don't think I've heard the whole song this entire. That's amazing.
The lyrics are insane. The way it's used in the beginning, it allows the audience to know, oh, this is, you're going to be able to laugh at some fucked up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If I can say that on your podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'll say that. So going back to how we were sitting around, I was sitting around at the screening, people that I didn't know, and I knew that I hadn't seen the film.
Yeah.
There's a scene, like the second scene of the movie, or, you know, thereabouts, the first big scene, which is pretty fucked up. Mm-hmm. And so we use the music, that song, the Arizona song, to kind of like play against what we're watching. And it totally worked. Like, these people were like laughing at the worst thing you should be laughing at. It was amazing.
There was applause. It was
so strange. That's the intent. You know, it was awesome.
That is the sweet spot we wanted to hit.
Well, I guess just wrapping things up here, I like to ask this of all our guests is, what kind of advice can you give to aspiring composers, I suppose, in this sense?
I guess to keep working, you know, I don't know. It's just keep making music.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess also sticking to what you do best or what you enjoy the most. I think that's important. I think sometimes you try to overextend and do things just to get a job or to try to sound like somebody else or to do what maybe is kind of outside your wheelhouse. You know, sometimes it works and you should always push yourself to do new things, but you know, if you're not enjoying it, or if it's not, you're kind of doing a disservice to yourself, I think.
What do you do in your free time when you're not composing? Like, what kind of music are you making when you're not composing for films, essentially? Like, are you trying to broaden your...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I write a lot of stuff on piano that just goes nowhere, you know, that just have like a hard drive full of music that I kind of keep in mind. So I have things to keep in mind for, you know, ideas, melodic ideas that could be used here and there. And so what I do in my own time, I don't know. I explore a lot of, recently I did a short film, that was like using a 20-piece orchestra. So I did all this like Hitchcock, like kind of Bernard Herrmann way out of my, canon, so to speak. But it was, it was amazing. It was fun to kind of, you know, work on, things that, you know, I'm not playing myself. I'm not playing piano or guitar or keyboard or drums or whatever. So it's, I mean, I'm kind of playing a lot of things. I have a lot of electronics. I have a lot of synthesizers, and I love, you know, folky guitar music and
thrash polka.
Thrash polka. I love
thrash polka.
And I love opera. I do like opera.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
you sob during opera.
I did. I have.
We're painting an odd picture.
Yeah, I mean, do you experiment with just sound in general?
Like, we did a lot of that for Arizona, where I went and I recorded a bunch of a cello bow, and bowed notes or strings on the piano, and then would feed them to my computer and just pitch shift them down, you know, by like 24 semitones or something, you know, like, and so just making them sound like an instrument, but sort of an unidentifiable instrument. And I did this another thing where I would like bend metal and bow it while bending it. And it has this like screeching kind of like human, like a woman screaming almost. It had a very human kind of metallic sound, but yeah, it, I don't know what it sounds like. It doesn't sound like an instrument really doing it. So we did a lot of that for the movie, and I would just kind of use a lot of that for some scenes. It kind of almost became like a theme. Once things kind of went off the rails, it kind of became like this sort of, you know, thematic idea that we would touch on a lot.
Yeah, it's dark and twisted, and you can't quite put your finger on what it is.
It's great for horror. I mean, you know, when you don't know what's coming like that. So then, Jonathan, I would ask, this is your first movie.
Yes, it is.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What advice would you give to aspiring directors?
Very good question. It's material, you know, just hunt for good material. I've written a couple of scripts. I did not write this one. Mm-hmm. But it's the material. Hunt it down, find it. If you can't find it, create it. Mm-hmm. That's my advice.
And like kind of what speaks to you in that sense.
Exactly. You're going to know it when you know it. It's like when it gets you in the gut, when it gets you, when you feel it.
Awesome.
You know, when you have a physical reaction to it, go for it.
Great. Well, thanks for talking to me, guys. This has been
thank you.
Great awesome. To meet you.
And yeah.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to the No Film School podcast and give us 5 stars. We'll be coming out with many more interviews from Sundance. This is the first of at least 10. So you can look forward to that over the next couple of weeks. We'll be back on Thursday with Indie Film Weekly. And until then, have a great week.